And the rest of you, let's open our Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We will be resuming at verse 15. First Corinthians chapter 9, verse 15. We stopped a little earlier than we anticipated last week, but we actually ended up stopping at a pretty good place in the text. Because chapter 8, the Apostle Paul was teaching us about non-essentials of the faith or liberties. And in the first part of chapter 9, the first 14 verses, Paul was now teaching us about rights, specifically his rights as an apostle of Jesus Christ, ministerial rights, we might say, but rights that bring up good points and make good principles for any of our Christian rights. So these are things that we can apply across the board. And in those first 14 verses, the major emphasis for Paul has been to go into detail with us about what his rights were as indeed a minister of the gospel, as an apostle of Jesus. So he's going, you know, into this kind of long account of, hey, I'm an apostle and it is fitting for me to do this. It is fitting for me to do that. It is fitting for me to do the other. Here's my rights. I want you to know I have complete control over this stuff, and no matter what anyone thinks, these are things that I could do. These are rights that I could exercise. But now, when we get to verse 15, now he's going to tell us what he does, what he has done, what he will continue to do with those rights, and that's going to consume the remainder of this chapter here, chapter 9. So let's begin reading at verse 15, let's find out what Paul's going to do with all of these rights that he's told us about. He's told us that, what, he has the right to eat whatever he wants, right? I can eat whatever I want, whether that means I can eat meat sacrificed to idols, that's my right. Whether that means I can eat a non-kosher diet if I want. Or whether that means just flat out, I have the right to eat, like I have the right to get the church's support. Whatever he means by that, he has the right. He has the right to get married. Remember that? If I want to, I don't have a wife right now, but if I want to, and we know Paul didn't, but if I want to, I could go find me a wife, find me a godly woman, I could marry her, that's my right, and then you all, the church, you'd have to support her financially if that's what I wanted. And then his last point, of course, was financial support. He had the right as a minister of the gospel to be supported by the church. We talked at that at length, perhaps ad nauseum last week. So let's see what Paul's going to do with all these rights. Verse 15, but I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision. So in short form, all of those rights that I just listed out, the right to be provided with meals from the churches that he ministers to, the right to take a wife and have her supported as well financially, the right to support himself financially from the churches that he's ministering to, all of those rights, he just now completely abandons and says, never used them, and I never plan on using them. He gave us 11 verses worth of trying to convince us of his rights. 11 verses. So after 11 verses, this sounds like a buildup. It sounds like Paul's moving towards something. You get to verse 15 when he's done talking about his rights, and here's what you're expecting him to say. You're expecting Paul to say, all right, so folks, here's the deal. Found myself a good woman. I'm going to get married, and I want you all to start providing financial support for our lifestyle. That's what you're expecting. Why spend 11 verses talking about your rights, and then when you're done, you say, yep, never used them, and I never plan on doing that. Why do that? Well, I can't give you a full answer on that. I believe that we do know one reason why he did that that's given to us in the scripture. The rest of it would be conjecture. I think probably, and this is an opinion, but probably he's doing this to try to get a little bit of respect back from some of the folks there in the fellowship that he seems to have fallen out of their graces. And this is an opportunity for him to remind them of the labor that he's done and the fact that he's done it for free. It's perhaps a chance at gaining some of that respect back. But for sure, he is going to give us some reasons here to let us know why he's doing that, and we'll hold that off for just a bit. But yeah, he's sounding very much like a guy who's defending something that he is either doing or is planning to do in the near future. We come to verse 15. He says, yep, never mind. All this stuff, could do, should do, never mind. Not going to do it. It's not what we're expecting. You know, like, okay, pay up, time to pay up. But instead, Paul just says, didn't do it back then, I'm not going to do it now. I didn't require your financial support in any way back then when I was pastoring that church for a year and a half, and I'm not going to start requiring that support now. So it begs the question then, if Paul goes 11 verses to tell us his rights, and then he tells us that he didn't use those rights and he doesn't plan on using those rights, then why is he giving us all of these rights in the first place? Why is he proving to them what they owe him only to say that, you know, that's okay, I'm not going to make use of it? Now, if we limit ourselves only to the text, then part of this is simply to explain why he hasn't taken a red cent from them, because that's what's ahead of us in the text. That's what we're going to find out. Again, we'll save that for just a moment, but I suspect the other reasons are good as well. Whatever his reasons, ministers everywhere, here's what it comes down to. We're just thrilled that Paul did give us those 11 verses explaining why he has the right, according to verse 14, to, as a preacher of the gospel, live from the gospel. We're just, you know, ministers everywhere, we're thrilled that Paul detailed this all out, because then when we're trying to work in our churches and there are funds available there, but the church is hesitant to give those funds to us and support us in the ministry, we now have a one-stop shop. All we have to do is bring them to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and say, you know, here you go. A person that's preaching the gospel should be able to live by the preaching of the gospel. It says it right here. Paul did all of the work for us. He gave us first, if you remember from last week, some just very common sense, everyday life examples. And then he dove into the scriptures and he listed out some scriptural proofs as to why that's a thing according to God. As to why God actually wants this to be a thing that's taking place. He wants his ministers to be financially supported by the churches that they're laboring in. So now, you know, we can just come right to this and say, okay, let's talk about salary now. That's a great thing for ministers. Paul did the hard work. Reading on in verse 15. For I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. What boasting is he talking about? That would be boasting in his financial independence and in the fact that he was able to minister the word of God to them at Corinth completely free of charge. But that's only half the scoop here. There's more to this, because right about now, being the well-versed Bible students that you are, you're wondering, is it really appropriate for Paul to boast about this? Is it really appropriate for him to say, you know, like, man, I am so thrilled to be able to share this with you. Guess how awesome I am. I am so awesome that you guys don't have to pay me anything to minister here. I can minister here to you for free. Aren't I great? Well, that kind of boasting would be wrong for sure. But is all boasting for a Christian, is it all bad? Should we just never boast at all? Well, certainly it's a nuanced thing in the Bible. We are taught not to boast in self, that's for sure. We are taught not to boast in any other human being because of the flawed nature of human beings. But we are enthusiastically encouraged to boast in the Lord over His greatness and over the things that He has done in our life. So basically, if our bragging glorifies God, then our bragging is A-okay with God. If our bragging glorifies us or another human being, then not so much. Because it's either in just at surface value wrong, or it has the potential to be wrong because of an up-and-coming downfall. So you could write these verses down to give you the full scoop on boasting. This is Proverbs 27:2. Let another praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips. So, you know, Solomon says, don't praise yourself. Let someone else do that. But then the rest of the Bible is going to tell everyone else, yeah, don't praise him, because he's just a man, right? Because then we have 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 21. So let no one boast in men, for all things are yours. So if everyone's doing what they're supposed to, then none of us are boasting in either ourselves or anyone else except for him. No human beings. Then we have 1 Corinthians 4:7. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? In other words, from the Lord. If then you received it, why do you boast as though you did not receive it? 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 31. This is the kicker here. Ready? This is the be-all, end-all of it. So that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. So what's our conclusion then regarding Paul's boasting? Yes, he's definitely boasting over financial independence and offering the gospel to Corinth for free. But our conclusion would need to be that Paul's not boasting in himself for accomplishing that. That he's actually boasting in the Lord for making that possible. He's actually boasting in the Lord's ability to provide for him without him needing to charge the church there at Corinth. So, you know, he didn't have to have congregants swipe their cards in order to continue teaching them the keys to spiritual maturity. He didn't have the potential new converts go out and purchase his book if they want to know how to get saved. He was able to offer all of that for free. And I do believe that he was glorifying the Lord in all of that. Much like Abraham, when Abraham rescued Lot, and there was a whole big war that was involved there in Genesis chapter 14. Nations were going at it, like kingdoms were going at it. And Abraham and his men got into the fray, and they attacked at night. They won. It was a great victory. They brought Lot and the family members back and all of the spoils of war, and they brought them back and just, boom, there you go, gave them back to the king of Sodom, all of their stuff. And the king of Sodom wanted Abraham to take all of those returned, recaptured goods. And Abraham flat out refused to. This is what he said in Genesis 14:23. He said, I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abraham rich. So Abraham wanted to put his trust in the Lord. He wanted to be able to say, the Lord has provided for me, not that king over there. He didn't want anyone to have the power to say, well, yeah, Abraham's rich, but he's only rich because I gave him, you know, all this stuff. I gave him 100 heads of livestock or pounds of gold. He didn't want anyone to have the power to say that. He wanted to be able to say, the Lord has provided for me. I think that's Paul's point here. I think that's what Paul has to be saying. That I want to be able to boast in how the Lord is providing for me in the ministry, how he's taking care of me. Then I don't have to be a burden on anyone else. I can just be thanking the Lord every day that I wake up. The Lord's putting the next meal on my table. Where do I stand on this? Well, I spent, as you know, I said 20 years last year. If you go back to before active, a more active ministry, if you go back to the lay ministry days, this is about 24 years. 24 years of my ministry, bivocational to some degree or another, sometimes less active in ministry, sometimes more active in ministry, but To be sure, about 24 years of bivocational ministry. And that was working a job on the side to provide for my money, for my living, and then taking the time that I could muster and then devoting that to study and prayer and preparation for some kind of ministry work and then delivering that ministry work. And it wasn't until it became undeniably apparent that the Lord had chose for me to pastor here, and then you all offered me a salary. I thank you last week for that, I believe, right? Thank you for making it possible for me to be full-time in the ministry. And when you offered me that salary, I did not hesitate to accept it and quit my job. Did not hesitate to do that. I was so looking forward to that because what can I say? I am no Paul. I'm just different than Paul. He could work all day making tents and selling tents and whatever he was doing that was intense. And he could still spend 5 hours a day, 6 days a week, teaching the Bible. Maybe that doesn't mean much to you, but as a Bible teacher, that means everything to me. Because my big question is, when was this guy studying? When was this guy prepping? Did he not sleep? Did he do it at night? And the answer is, he didn't need to study. He could teach through all of the Bible without studying. I am not there yet. I still need about 21 hours of study per teaching. And because of that, yeah, I'm different than Paul. My focus is, okay, Lord, I need a living, and I still want as much time in the ministry as possible. So a full-time salary, well, that works for me. And yeah, it'd be great if I could reject the salary like Paul is doing. If I could reject the salary and all of the money you're spending on me, just soak that into ministry for the local church, I would love that. Can you imagine the things that we could do? We could go to Sight and Sound Lancaster twice a year, in Jerusalem, in the Holy Lands. We could establish more ministries locally. We could pay more of our folks. I wish we could do that, and I give you my promise, if I ever am digging around on my property and strike oil or find gold, I will do just that. I will reject the salary from that day forward. But don't get your hopes up, because I've done a lot of digging in the yard. You know I've had a lot of trouble with my water lines, digging them up 5-6 times a year to try to fix a hole. I've never come across oil or gold. And unfortunately for y'all, we just put in a new well, so I don't plan on digging that new one up. I don't think I'm going to be doing any more digging. But if I do, if I strike it rich, then I will submit my offering right back to you. Until then, I'm just so grateful to be freed up to be full-time in the ministry. Verse 16, for if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. So the reason Paul didn't feel as though he had the right to boast about preaching the gospel, that was all based on his view that his call from God was an obligation. Now, he considered it a willing obligation. We studied that in Romans, but he still did look at that as a willful obligation that he held, that God called him to do that. So that was a non-negotiable in his life. And you just add that to what we know from the previous verse. And here's what we get. Paul didn't feel as though he could boast in preaching the gospel alone. But if the Lord had provided financially for him and he was able to preach the gospel for free, now that he felt like he could boast about, right? Isn't that what we just read in those two verses? He wants to be able to boast in the Lord providing for him. He doesn't feel like he can boast just in the fact that he's doing what the Lord called him to do by preaching. So that's why he wants to hang on to this so tightly. And anchored, it's important that you know this. What does woe mean? What does woe mean? Not like hold your horses, not like, you know, W-H-O-A, but W-O-E. What does woe mean? That means, I heard someone say it, sorry or sorrow. So when we read this, with a more recognizable word to us that helps us with the interpretation. Sorrowful am I if I do not preach the gospel. And the reason I want to stress that is because for some reason, it has become a pretty common thing for folks to read that verse, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel, and for some reason believe that Paul was speaking about damnation if he refused the call to preach the gospel. There are folks that actually believe that. I admit that in my younger, more legalistic days, it even made me nervous. Because I knew I had a call to minister the word. And I felt like, well, then that's it. I have to do that. I can't just say no to the call of God. But this is not referring to damnation if you refuse the call to ministry work. Do I think that people who refuse the call to ministry are still saved if they still believe in Jesus and still want to walk with the Lord? Of course I do. I believe these are two completely separate issues. And if they weren't, then the gospel would be very different, wouldn't it? The gospel, the saving gospel would be, well, if you believe on Jesus and you fulfill the calling that God has placed on your life, then you shall be saved. But that's not the gospel. These are two separate things. Salvation is all about faith. First, we are justified by our faith. Justified is perfect status with God, declared perfectly righteous. And a call to minister always comes after salvation. It's subsequent to salvation. And we handle it separately. Now, for sure, everyone who receives a call into the ministry, they should pursue that call. They should work on fulfilling that call. But those who are truly saved, they love the Lord and just decide for whatever reason to reject the call to ministry, I assure you they're not damned because they rejected the call to ministry. I know people like that. I've got folks that I know in my life that will tell me that very thing. I know I was called to preach, and I didn't want to. I rejected it. Now, their recourse, I think, because of a misunderstanding of this verse, is to go as far in the opposite direction as possible and to say, well, if I'm rejecting the call to ministry, then I guess I can't be saved. The Lord won't receive me just as a servant. Where do we get those kind of misconceptions from? When has it ever been about our works? When has it ever been about the things we do or don't do? It's about, are we truly wanting to be His servant or not? He's not going to turn away anyone that wants to be His servant. If you want to be His servant, then we're going to see you in heaven one day, regardless of all of the other things that are separate to that. Verse 17, for if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with a stewardship. So that's the way that it works in ministry. If you minister willfully and happily, there's great reward in that. There's a reward now. There's a reward later on, as you stand before the Lord and He judges your works. If you minister begrudgingly, then you lose those rewards. Any reward you would have hoped to get from the work, you lose it. Paul and Barnabas would be examples of men that ministered willfully and happily. And Jonah and Jeremiah would be examples of men who ministered begrudgingly. But what did they all have in common? They all did what God called them to do. They all did as God directed. Two of them did it because, yes, their hearts were in it. Two of them did it, all right, if I have to. Lord, I just didn't want you to save those horrible Ninevites, but I'll do it if I have to. Or, Lord, I'm done speaking for you. It's just causing trouble. As Paul taught us in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, motivation is everything when it comes to rewards for works. It's everything. We're tempted to think it's about the successes of our labors. It is not. It has nothing to do with how well we do what we're doing for the Lord. It's all about motivations. It is all about the heart when it comes to rewards. But here's the truth. Whether your heart is always in it or not, you still got to do it. If God called you to do it, if he directed you to do it, then you need to do it. Ministry is not a hobby. A hobby you can quit when you get bored with it or frustrated with it or when it's getting too expensive. Amen? You can quit a hobby. This is not a hobby. This is a spiritual calling. This is something God placed on your life, and it's going to be like that at times. There's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be periods where you're doing it and your heart, your gumption is behind it and you're enjoying it. And then there's going to be other times where it's, oh, Lord, help me get through this. This is wearing on me. It's grating on me. Help, Lord. You're going to have that. The ups and downs, the momentary ups and downs of just typical human life and human work, that's going to happen. So again, this is not teaching damnation to those who reject ministry callings. This is simply a statement of the necessity of being committed to the work that God calls you to. It is a truly vocation that requires complete dedication, even amidst the ups and downs of life. You just got to keep at it, regardless of how you're feeling. Verse 18. What then is my reward that in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel? And that would be his right to be funded by the church. Now, I told you last week that the Bible always connects work and reward. And I shared with you last week that everything that we are working on, any area where we put forth the effort of work, we are doing that for the purpose of some kind of reward. And I know you'll hear this statement a lot, that I'm not doing this for any kind of reward. I'm not doing this for any kind of benefit. I'm just doing this because of whatever. And usually, whatever it is that they say, the reason they're doing it for, that's actually the reward that they're aiming for. So if you think, well, there are things in my life that I do that I don't do for reward, I would really love to challenge you and have a little talk with you. I bet within 2 minutes I could crack whatever it is that serves as your reward for the work that you're doing. For example, as a mom or as a dad, you don't take care of kids or spouse for free with no reward. You do that for a reward. They may not pay you. That does not mean you're not doing it for a reward. You do it for a reward. The reward there would be that you love them. You want to see them happy, healthy, and well taken care of. Don't tell me that's not a reward. That is a reward. That's the exact reward that you're going for when you do that kind of work. You don't volunteer at a homeless shelter just for the sake of no reward. Again, they may not pay you. But if I ask you, well, why are you doing it? How does it make you feel when you do that? Oh, makes me feel so good. It gives me the warm and fuzzies. There you go. That's the reward. That's why you're doing it, because it's better to give than to receive. You're getting a feeling of satisfaction and helpfulness to community out of that when you do that. That's your reward. And Paul now has just given us his reward. He says, here's my reward for preaching the gospel in Corinth for free. The reward is this: that I get to preach the gospel in Corinth for free. What can I say? Sometimes the work is the reward itself. Sometimes we love the work that we are doing so much that as we do it, we're just completely satisfied with it. That's the reward itself. And that was definitely, certainly true for Paul. Paul loved getting people to heaven for free. He loved that. Free tickets to heaven. You don't have to buy my book. I'll tell you for free how to get to heaven. Paul loved that. Verse 19, for though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. Now, he's not foolish enough to say that I might win every single person. He just says more. You know, I want just more advantage, a chance to win more numbers of people. Vocationally and religiously, Paul was free. He was a freed man. He had no tent-making boss barking out orders and demanding overtime and long hours from him. He had no board of directors controlling what he did or didn't do in his ministry. This man was not under authority. The only authority that Paul was under would be the authority of the Roman government and under the authority of God. So this was a very free man. And yet from that enviable position of complete freedom, he willfully submitted himself as a servant to the churches that he ministered to, and not just the church folks, as you're going to see here. He's not just talking about Christians that he's working for. He's talking about all people. All people that he would be trying to reach for Christ. He willfully put himself in that position. Servant is from the Greek word doulos. We've covered that in the study before. It can mean either voluntary or involuntary slavery. But in the context that the New Testament authors use it, it would be voluntary slavery that we're talking about. So the best picture that is given to us is from the Old Testament example of slavery as detailed out according to the law of Moses. And the way it worked is, as a Jewish slave, you could work for another Jew for 6 years, and then after that sixth year, on the seventh year, you would be set free. So it was a temporary thing. It had terms. And once you were set free, you now had a choice. You could choose your freedom and be a completely freed person. Or if you really liked life under the roof of that master that you were serving, you could choose at that time to make a permanent, lifelong commitment, willful commitment to that master to be his slave. And that's how Paul uses this in the New Testament. If you put the little twist to it, it would be the guy that goes to the slave market and purchases a slave. And then instead of putting that slave to work, he says, okay, you're free. I purchased you for freedom. And that's how Christ purchased us out of our bondage of slavery to sin in the world. We're now free, but we have willfully chosen to serve him. We've willfully chosen for him to be our master. That's how Paul is using this. That is how he views himself in regard to the Christians that he serves and the non-Christians that he's trying to reach. And the reason that's different is because in the New Testament, almost every time we're talking about a person being a servant, that is always in reference to their relationship with the Lord, and not as often in reference to their relationship with other people. But that's what we get here. Paul's talking about his relationship to other people. And it goes right along with what Jesus taught. From the beginning, Jesus taught the disciples, those who would be the greatest, like if you really want to be something in the kingdom, be servant of all. Just like be the best servant, be the most committed servant. You know, the way up is the way down. To be exalted, you humble yourself. And now Paul gives us a breakdown of that beginning in verse 20. In verse 20, he says, to the Jews, I became a Jew in order to win Jews. That is referring not just to unbelieving Jews, but specifically to unbelieving Jews who were not orthodox in their practices. They didn't have a faith that they were expressing. They didn't go to the temple. They didn't live by the law of Moses. They were irreligious completely. Those are the people that Paul's talking about first here in verse 20. Not following the law of Moses at all. Not religious at all. Though Paul was an ultra-Orthodox Jew, he had no problem relating to this demographic of folks. It was a piece of cake for him, because he had some things in common here. I know it says he became a Jew to them, but he was a Jew. He didn't have to become a Jew in that sense. He was a Jew, born of the tribe of Benjamin. So there was that instant cultural understanding as to how a Jew, religious, irreligious, didn't matter, how a Jew would think, speak, and live their life. Paul knew all that stuff. And so he could manage just fine in company with folks like that. Verse 20, reading on, it says, to those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. And obviously then, he's now referring to unbelieving Jews who were orthodox in their practice of Judaism. So they believed in God Old Testament God, they did not believe that Jesus was the Son of God and their Messiah. So they believed in Old Testament God, but not in New Testament Jesus. And it was all the easier for Paul to reach this group of people and relate to this demographic of people because not all that long before, that was Paul's life to a T. That's exactly where he was in life. He knew what made these kinds of people tick. And as a Christian, I think we all have those advantages. We have that advantageous position of being poised and primed to reach certain people that are just like we used to be before we came to Christ and were set free from our sins. For me, it's legalists and cultists. I understand folks like that because I used to be one of them. I know exactly where their thinking goes. I know exactly what their argument's going to be when I state a truth. I'm just always ready to speak to folks like that. For Paul, that was the ultra-Orthodox Jews. That was his group. So they were always the first group that he would try to reach for Christ when he entered a new town that he had never been to before. Because he knew he had that advantageous position of putting himself in their shoes, trying to reach them, and he rightfully assumed that based on their knowledge base, based on their beliefs, based on their practices, they were closest to the kingdom. They were ripest for the picking. I feel the same way about the legalists and the cultists. They are so close. They got the right Jesus. They have some of the truth. They're very close to the kingdom. Unfortunately, closest to the kingdom does not always equate to easiest to bring into the kingdom. Sometimes the closest to the kingdom folks are the most stubborn, obstinate folks, and they're the most difficult to get that last final step into the kingdom. Paul certainly came to learn that about the unbelieving Jews as well. And most of the time they're toughest to win because they are dogmatic about their doctrines. You know, stuff that they were taught. There's no budge there. So it's difficult. But Paul made his attempts to reach the unbelieving Jews by becoming just like them in many regards. That's what he means. Like, I'm just blending in. I'm talking the language. I'm doing the stuff. First thing he would do is he would start by attending their synagogue services. And he didn't have to do that. He could have determined to be very distinctly Christian. He could have drawn those lines and said, look, the synagogue model, guys, that's old. The Lord's doing a new thing now. It's the church. It's church services. Here's what we're doing. We're not doing the old synagogue thing again. We're no longer limited to our recited prayers. We can talk to the Lord one-on-one. He could have dug his heels in on the distinctly Christian stuff. But instead, here's Paul showing up at synagogue meetings every week, every Sabbath, going through the motions, saying the prayers that the Jews say because they don't violate any of his Christian principles, doing everything he can to blend into that culture, that religious happening, so that he can get the chance in the very near future to get a plug or two or 10 or 20 or 50 in for salvation through Jesus Christ as the Messiah. So yeah, if you're trying to reach a Jew, you have to become a Jew. Verse 21, to those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ. He says, I don't want you to think I was completely lawless here. No, I'm under law, that I might win those outside the law. And that would be referring to the unbelieving Gentiles now. You would think that'd be the toughest group for Paul to relate to and try to win, but really it's not. Because though Paul was, yes, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, he was born in Tarsus. And Tarsus, there was a law in the Roman Empire that anyone born in Tarsus, they were born with birthright citizenship. That means if you're born here in this region, in this city, then you are instantly granted birthright citizenship. You are a freed man or woman of Rome. And that was Paul. He was birthright citizenship. We have something similar to that in our country now. The current administration is trying to tweak it. I think it's really smart to tweak it, because currently the way it stands is if an illegal immigrant has a child in this country, the child's legal and they're not. So what do you do when you catch the illegal parents? Do you ship them back to wherever they came from and keep the kid because he's a citizen? No, he's ours now. I don't think you do that. There's obvious problems there, but I digress. Paul was born in Tarsus with birthright citizenship. So he was well acquainted with Roman law. That oozes off the pages of his writings. It's very obvious Paul understood Roman law very well. He leveraged that knowledge in his many court cases, in his many hearings before judges and rulers over his ministry with the gospel. He knew Roman law. He knew Roman life. He knew what Gentiles did and how they thought as well. This guy was basically a Christian chameleon. He could blend in anywhere. He was pretty amazing at it. And all for one purpose. Verse 22, to the weak I became weak that I might win the weak. And who would the weak be? Those who can't lift more than 100 pounds? No. Has nothing to do with physical strength. The weak here would be the same weak that Paul is always referring to when he talks about the weak. It would be the same weak from Romans chapter 14. The same weak from 1 Corinthians chapter 8. These would be the weaker Christians who have weaker consciences because they're overactive consciences. And they end up making more rules than God ever did. They end up calling things sin that God doesn't call sin. And Paul could get down on those folks' level too. He understood them. He knew they loved the Lord so much that usually that's where that comes from. I love the Lord so much, I don't even want to get close to messing up. So let me build a couple fences around that so I don't even get close. He knew that. He knew they just didn't want to displease the Lord. And yes, he knew they needed to lighten up. He taught us that. We studied that. Romans 14, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he taught us that. Yeah, they need to lighten up. They need to grow up in the Lord. They need to let go of stuff that's non-essential to their salvation. But then how did Paul handle that? And how did he teach us to handle that in both of those places, Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians chapter 8? Beat them up? Argue with them? No. Avoid the things that you know are going to offend them, because you don't want to encourage them to do something against their conscience and sin against their conscience, thereby sinning against the Lord. And you don't want to do anything to offend them and push them away from the Lord altogether. You don't want to wreck their faith. So you give in. You sacrifice. Okay, you think meat offered to idols is a sin? All right, fine. I'm not going to eat meat offered to idols while you're around. You think it's a sin to eat bacon? You're still under the kosher laws of Leviticus 11? Fine, I'm not going to eat bacon. Sacrifice I couldn't make, folks, but Paul could. You know, it's submitting, it's sacrificing in order to help the weaker. I am still connected to people who think anything and everything is a sin. They think I'm a sinner for wearing a wedding band. None of the folks in their church will wear a wedding band. I guess they're okay with no one knowing whether they're married or not. That's okay for them, but they are completely against jewelry of any sort, so they think I'm a sinner for wearing a wedding band. So to apply Paul's logic, it would be like me and Maggie being out somewhere and seeing some of these folks, knowing what church they go to, and saying to Maggie, oh, look who it is. They're here. Here, Maggie, quick, put your ring in here. Okay. Yeah, we don't want them to see that. How you doing? No ring. How you doing? That would be a similar thing. And it feels kind of slimy when you do it, but really that's what Paul teaches you to do. Now, I don't do that because they have bigger problems with me than my rings. I won't go into it. Stuff that I'm doing that I know the Lord is either pleased by or has approved for me, but things that they're just sure I am a sinner, I'm a reprobate. So yeah, I've got bigger fish to fry with them So I'm to the point with folks like that I'm not going to sacrifice in order not to offend them and try to win them. But if there's someone in your life where you can make those kinds of measures to do that, then Paul would certainly say that's the way to go. You'll notice that Paul does not mention the strong in the faith. Did you notice that? He does not mention the strong in the faith here. He's mentioned the unbelieving Jews who have no religion at all. Like they're just atheist, agnostic, what have you. He's mentioned the religious Jews that don't believe in Jesus yet. He's mentioned Gentiles who don't know Christ yet. And not just unbelievers. He's even talked about weaker Christians. But he's not talked about strong Christians. And the reason he hasn't talked about strong Christians is because that's Paul's exact current category. That is the position he's trying to bring everyone to. Everyone from those other categories. That's where he's trying to get them. The unbelievers, of course, get them saved, but get them up here with me as a strong Christian. And even over here with the believers, the weaker believers who are troubled over everything. Everything convicts them. Everything's a sin. Paul wants to get them up here with him too, to the point where they could be a strong Christian. Reading on in verse 22, I have become all things to all people that by all means I might save some. That sounds exhausting. Becoming all things to all people. Do you feel like that's your week sometimes? Like, well, I got to go run and do this for her. Then the kids need that and I got to go do that. I got to take care of that and got to run to the... Yeah, I think you feel that way sometimes. I'm doing everything for everyone. I don't have any time for myself. But this opens up completely here at this statement. He's not just limiting this to the four category groups that he gave us, the obvious ones, the big ones. This is referring to every single kind of people group in any kind of category in life that you can possibly think of. Whatever the demographic, whatever the culture, whatever the position in life, whatever socioeconomic status, this was Paul saying, I apply my chameleon Christianity to that or whatever. I try to become all things to those people. I try to blend right in so that I can relate to them, so that I can speak to their hearts if by chance I might win their heart to faith in Jesus. When it comes to meeting people where they are, Paul was great at this, but Jesus was the master. He's always the master. I love to study through the Gospels and see how perfectly Jesus did this. How he would become all things to all people. I mean, the master, not just of blending in, but the master of all creation. We should read Philippians 2 for this, the kenosis chapter, the emptying of himself, coming down into our dirt and being among us, living like us, relating to us, being a sympathetic high priest to us. The stories are wonderful. When Jesus was around farmers, he became like a farmer to them. He talked to them in that language. He spoke to them in their interests. And from that, he would teach them truth and try to bring them to the Lord. Went around a lady that was thirsty and drawing water. He approached her as a thirsty man wanting water. And he talked to her from that base in order to get her faith in him as Messiah. Went around fishermen. He became like a fisherman. He talked to them in their language. He gave them stories that taught truth. But using that language that would be familiar and effective to a fisherman. And he was the best kind of fisherman because he always knew where the fish were at. You never went fishing with Jesus and came back without a boat full. All things to all people so that we can win them. How important that is for us. We're just, you know, again, I go back to this. We're still on the topic from last week, so it all comes back to where we started, our culture. It's a very selfish, self-centered culture. We don't want to budge to help anyone. How many videos have you seen of someone hurt? How many people walk on past and drive on past? We can't be bothered by other people. And Paul knows nothing of that kind of lifestyle. Paul thinks we ought to be bothered by everyone in a good way. that we see where people are and that we reach them where we are, or where they are, pardon me. That we try to get into their thinking so that we can relate to them better. Verse 23, finishing up. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. So Paul would get in there and mix it up with anyone on their terms in order just to give himself the opportunity to plug for faith in Jesus as the Messiah. Now these verses, they get abused by people who are looking for biblical reasons to compromise righteousness. You won't actually find support for that in the Bible. This certainly does not support that. This is merely Paul expressing to us that he did not hold on to any one methodology for reaching people with the gospel. The gospel was the first priority for Paul. Methodology was second. Methodology was to be changeable. We have that right in our core values. The message, never changing, always the same. Today, yesterday, forever. The grass withers, the flower fades. The word of the Lord will stand forever. The message, never changing. The method, always changing. Because people are always changing. And we want to reach them. Let's stand. Let's pray.